warriors. They were confident in their ability to block and parry a wide range of attacks. Whether they came from monsters, bandits, or even other adventurers didn't matter. They would deflect them all and hold the line. However, they could not keep up with this onslaught. The sheer number of blows raining down on them meant they had no breathing room. Exhausted and disheartened, they desperately tried to hold the monster back while getting covered in scratches. But they still had faith. Faith that, if given enough time, that elf would be able to do something about this nightmarish creature. They believed that from the bottom of their hearts. But such a thing did not happen. Lelandros was already running away with all his might. His elven nature screamed at him to save himself. His experience growing up in the gutter told him to run for his life, and his fear-addled mind had absolutely no desire to stick around. And so, he ran. Comrades, lovers, friends, you can buy plenty of those if you had money. But you couldn't have any of that if you died in a forest somewhere. Besides, he had a duty. He had to report the appearance of that terrifying monster to the authorities. The proper subjugation quest needed to be put out, and stronger adventurers had to be called in from the south. Dying there would be a disservice to his comrades who were still fighting to buy him time to escape. At least, that was what he told himself. Back at that blood-soaked battlefield, Crom and Brom were both inevitably slain. They fought valiantly, but they were in a hopeless position. Wounded, tired, and abandoned, they died to a monster's blade slowly, painfully, and gripped by despair. Their passing was so dreadful that it was highly likely they would come back as the undead if their killer wasn't planning on absorbing their corpses. The mimic danced on their bloodied bodies. Its hastily made plan resulted in a massive harvest. Since someone else had already heavily wounded the Janther before this opportunist showed up and stole the kill, it only got partial credit. Still, that, combined with the other two kills it got, was enough to earn it 3 levels for its mimic job. The pointy-eared one got away, which was a bit of a shame, but all things considered, this was a very profitable engagement. After it had settled down, it went over to the non-viable corpse and began eating the dead woman. While it was doing that, it also went through its status. It had earned a lot of things it didn't have time to double-check before, so now was a good time to verify. And just like the spell list, that new thing it saw should have its own screen. It still had no idea what exactly a perk was, though. Perk list. Arcane Assassin. Monster Magic. Perk. A special effect that had been made available by fulfilling specific conditions. You can inspect individual perks for more information. Arcane Assassin. Every assassin worth their salt knows that silence is golden. Requirements? Kill an opponent of equal or higher level with a single spell while the stealth skill is active. Effects. Spells cast while the stealth skill is active will be completely silent. Spells cast while the stealth skill is active will cost 25% more MP. Monster Magic. A being born of mana is naturally more skilled at manipulating it. Requirements? Obtain any level 5 caster job as a monster. Effects. All spells are 5% more effective. So, perks were similar to skills, except they wouldn't grow stronger with time. Obtaining them seemed to be mostly at random, too. How was anyone supposed to figure it out outside of blind luck? The mimic complained slightly to nobody in particular. Well, not like it had a firm grasp on how to unlock general skills, either. Truthfully, adventurers could share this information and help each other become that slight bit stronger. They were all essentially competitors, so they only revealed such things to those they trusted. And nobody was about to trust a monster that was currently busy eating the corpse of a person it murdered in cold blood. Next, the mimic needed to verify its new magic. Ebonfire. Requirements. Level 3 Warlock. Intelligence, 20. School, Ruin. Type, Targeted. Cost, 100 MP. Range, 25 meters. Effects. Engulfs your target's soul in flames, burning away their body over 6 seconds. Has no effect on undead, demons, and golems. Mass Panic. Requirements, Level 5 Warlock, Intelligence 15, Mental Fortitude 15. School, Domination. Type, area effect. Cost, 50 MP. Range, 5 meters. Effects. Sends all living things in the immediate area into a magically induced panic attack. Has no effect on undead, demons, and golems. Ebonfire seemed to be like a powerful spell, but with limited usage and 100 MP also seemed like a really steep cost. On the upside, it looked like it left the actual body in one piece, which was good. The Mimic didn't want to invalidate any more corpses if it could help it. As for mass panic, it seemed to be of limited use. It was also of a school of magic different to ruin. Domination. A school of magic that focuses on influencing the mind. Domination spells do not deal physical damage and instead cause debilitating conditions. Domination spells will display stronger or weaker effects depending on the difference between the mental attributes of the caster and the target. Repeated use of domination spells against the same target will show reduced effectiveness. So it was something that seemed completely unreliable, at least for hunting. This was the simple truth the Mimic's noticeably boosted mental abilities realized. Still, the incantation was really short, so it might be useful as an escape mechanism. Having finished devouring the druid, the Mimic moved onto the Janther's corpse. While it would definitely use cadaver absorption on it, the monster first needed to rectify a problem. It couldn't see in the dark. But this six-legged beast could clearly see it last night. Therefore, the Mimic wanted those eyes. It had to eat them to copy them properly. Technically, eating a part of the corpse now would reduce the effectiveness of cadaver absorption, but some things were more important than attributes or skills. And even then, it was only going after that one tiny part of its face. Compared to the rest of the gigantic body, they were so insignificant that it probably wouldn't make a difference anyway. So the shapeshifter gouged them out slowly with a sword and then put them in its mouth. It rolled them around on its tongue before slowly chewing them up and swallowing them. The sole human eye on its surface then morphed. Its color changed from a dull brown to a bright yellow. A vertical line ran down the golden iris, giving it the appearance of a cat eye. The Mimic would need to wait until it got dark again to properly calibrate it, but it was a start. Since it had enough MP, it absorbed the entirety of the Janther. What appeared to be thousands of liters of gray sludge disappeared inside its body, leaving behind a pile of skin and bones that crumbled away slowly in the gentle breeze. Unfortunately, it was a failure and nothing was gained. The Mimic immediately felt a pang of regret. Hundreds of kilograms of delicious fresh meat just went to waste. It might actually mourn for it, if it knew the concept of grief. Still, it had two more usable corpses it could absorb, so it might get lucky anyway. But that would need to wait until its MP recovered some more. Right now, it had one more important piece of business with its status screen.
"Skill list! Harlock!"
it chanted. The screen came up as expected, but it seemed it only had one skill on offer. This was because, simply put, it was missing supporting general skills. For example, if it had the taboo skill, it might unlock Hexcraft. But as it stood, it had to make do with what it got. Summon Familiar. The warlock can call forth demons from the beyond and bend them to his will. Requirements: Level 5 Warlock, Intelligence 30. Type: Active. Activation time, 10 seconds. Cost, 50% of max MP. Range, 15 meters. Effects. Summons a contracted demon to serve as the warlock's familiar and obey his orders. A summoned familiar will last until it dies or the warlock dismisses it. The familiar's strength is dependent on the level of this skill and the MP used to summon it. Allows the creation of one demonic contract. Beware. Demons do not like to be shackled. Having some company would be good. Not that the Mimic was getting lonely or anything. It just understood the concept of strength in numbers. And if that didn't work, it would at least find out if demons tasted good. General information. You may skip to the next chapter. Mimic. Lesser. Genderless. 2 months old. Level 18 Mimic. Level 5 Warlock. 178 out of 376 HP, plus 0.6 per second, 35 out of 305 MP, plus 0.4 per second. Attributes. Strength, 51. Dexterity, 56. Agility, 45. Endurance, 65. Intelligence, 61. Wisdom, 49. Luck, 12. Mental fortitude, 24. Mimic skills. Assassination, level 4. Storage, level 3. Cadaver absorption, level 2. Warlock skills. Summon familiar, level 1. Other skills. Shapeshift, level 4. Stealth, level 3. Sword mastery, level 5. Ruin mastery, level 2. Part 3. Lelandros never wanted much out of life. Just to become really famous and get all the ladies. A simple, straightforward dream. But that was then. And this was now. Thoughts of fame and fortune were so far removed from his consciousness that he questioned if he really had them in the first place.
"Oi, Twiggy,"
came a voice from outside his cell.
"Cap'n will see you now."
Lelandros meekly got up from the pile of hay that served as his bed for the night. Not like he could fall asleep, anyway. His night terrors wouldn't let him. The horrifying scenery of that girl he sort of liked exploding all over him was still fresh in his mind. He remembered it vividly like it was yesterday. Although that's not really surprising, considering that's precisely when that happened. He ambled over to the iron bars that made up his cell door and put his hands through a gap in the vertical bars. The guard on the other side cuffed the elf's wrists with solid iron shackles connected by a short, thick chain. Lelandros pulled his wrists back inside so that the guard could unlock and open the cell. He roughly grabbed the shackled elf by the arm and almost literally dragged him off. This all happened so smoothly and methodically, onlookers might have mistaken it for a well-rehearsed play. It was just that, like most small-time hoodlums, Lelandros was no stranger to being locked up. His captors would insult and manhandle him all the time, so this treatment was nothing new. Truth be told, he was actually glad to be in here. It was safe and quiet. They even confiscated his soiled clothes and armor. The elf would probably never see those again, but that was undoubtedly a good thing for his peace of mind. Right now, the only thing he was wearing was a pair of rough, ragged trousers that did little more than preserve his dignity. The brown cloth was so rough and riddled with holes that it wouldn't be a surprise if these pants were sewn together from old potato sacks. The armed guard roughly escorted him through the damp, rat-infested dungeon. About a dozen tiny jail cells, much like his own, dotted the dark corridor. Wall-mounted torches illuminated the thick walls made out of hewn stone. Intermittent cries from the other prisoners could be heard echoing around him. Lelandros and the jailer eventually reached the steep staircase that was the only way in or out of this depressing place. They climbed up out of the dungeon and into the keep proper. The walls looked pretty much the same, but at least there were windows here. Lelandros was guided through several corridors, up some more steps, and finally arrived at the office of the local guard captain. His escort rapped twice on the thick wooden door. After hearing the
"Coming!"
he opened it and dragged his prisoner inside, throwing him roughly onto the floor.
"Hey, come on,"
complained the captain. He was a slightly plump, balding man way past his prime. He stood up from behind the heavy desk in the middle of the room.
"Don't do that. You'll stain the carpet."
"Sorry, sir," said the guard.
"This one was rather violent yesterday, so I..." "Enough. I don't care. Just put him in the damn chair so I can interrogate him."
The grunt replied with a simple,
"Yes, sir,"
before picking up the scrawny elf by the armpit and putting him in the simple wooden chair next to the desk. The captain eyed the prisoner up and down. He looked like the typical hoodlum elf, lanky, hollowed-out face and several scars from various stab wounds. He was certain he had whip tracks over his back as well, but that was unimportant. This particular street rat had entered this city yesterday afternoon. Well, entered was perhaps too strong a word. He ran up to the city gates covered in blood and started screaming something about explosions, brains, and a horrible monstrosity. Since he caused a disturbance and refused to calm down, the guards at the scene subdued and incarcerated him. It was the same day that the big incident at the nearby dungeon complex was discovered. Captain Reeves knew better than to assume it to be a coincidence. Although it took some time for him to go through all the reports, his experience told him this elf and the disappearance of his patrol were somehow linked. When the five-man unit failed to report back on time, Reeves had sent in a contingent of 30 guards to look for them. And they had made several extremely worrying discoveries. First, they found 4 piles of clothed ashes, former adventurers by the look of it. The dog tags recovered from the remains revealed their names as well as which guild they belonged to. Using that information, the guards learned these 4 were on their way to the yellow zone of the complex. That meant they weren't total newbies and were between level 5 and 10. Otherwise, they would have stuck to the green zone or moved on to the red zone that went up to level 15. The second clue the investigation uncovered was on the way to the quarantined area of the green zone. The walls and floor of a particular tunnel were bathed in dried-up blood. Dead monsters and their bodily fluids would be absorbed back into the dungeon as a form of mana recycling. This meant this particular blood came from those outside of the dungeon's influence. And judging by the bloodied pieces of armor that had been discarded all over the place, it came from Reeves' patrol. The third, and perhaps most worrying thing, was that the quarantine itself had been breached. His guards brought back the circular portion of enchanted steel that had been neatly cut through. This degree of precision and power was way beyond everything the veteran officer had ever seen. The dwarf responsible for putting that grate together claimed it would take something that was well over level 70 to make that sort of cut.
Or someone, Reeves thought.
Several high-leveled elven terrorists were still at large. This sort of sabotage was clearly within their abilities and lined up with their M.O. He theorized they had heard about the appearance of a sweeper and cut it loose to spread terror among the populace. The captain estimated the sweeper itself was a threat between level 20 and 30. If it were any weaker, it wouldn't be able to kill that necromancer or take down 5 of his guards at once. If it were any tougher, it would have broken through the steel grate with sheer force within days rather than 2 weeks later. And now, this suspicious elf was in his office. His background check revealed he joined his guild as an initiate only recently. That was good enough reason to assume he wasn't the one who sabotaged the quarantine. After all, things like adventurers hiding their true powers was impossible. The organizations known as guilds had all their members undergo routine appraisal inspections to track their growth and progress. If a level 70 no-name appeared out of nowhere and offered to join a guild, it would cause a huge uproar. They definitely wouldn't leave such a person as a mere initiate. Doing so would be disrespectful to their more senior members. Still, Lelandros' guild refused to tell Reeves anything other than the elf's rank within their organization. All guilds collected and recorded information concerning the jobs, attributes, and skills of all their members. However, that was kept strictly confidential. Requests to release that data to people like Reeves were reviewed on a case-by-case basis and usually declined. It wasn't unheard of for adventurers to become criminals, but their guilds needed more than mere suspicion to comply with such demands. Then again, even the fact he was an initiate was good enough for Reeves. It was more than he usually got out of those people. It was also sufficient grounds to dismiss this elf as the main perpetrator, though he could still be an accomplice. After sorting his thoughts, the captain began the interrogation. He asked the man's name, age, and occupation for the record, then inquired about the events of yesterday's afternoon. The elf answered his questions without holding anything back. He spoke of their Janther hunt, of his comrade's sudden and violent demise, of how the horrible creature tortured their quarry to death, and finally how he ran screaming for his life. The way he spoke about such terrible events with a flat monotone and vacant, fish-like eyes left little doubt in the captain's mind. The young man before him was broken by what he had witnessed.
"Thank you," said the captain, concluding the interrogation. "Private, show this man back to his cell. Gently this time. I mean, for real, be gentle. It's not some euphemism to rough him up, okay?"
The guard saluted with a,
"Yes, sir,"
before turning to his prisoner.
"Come on, Twiggy, up you go,"
he beckoned. He lifted him by his shoulder and led the man outside the captain's office.
"Oh,"
exclaimed Reeves,
"send word to Sergeant Hargan that I need to speak with him when you are done."
The guard nodded with another,
"Yes, sir,"
then slammed the door shut. Now left alone, Reeves let out a long, tired sigh.
Fuck this,
he cursed, and reached over to one of his desk drawers. He pulled out a bottle of wine, uncorked it, and took a mouthful straight from the bottle. He was gradually becoming an alcoholic over the last several weeks, all because of this damned sweeper. A sweeper was a term used to describe a particular abnormality within a dungeon, a monster that had broken way past the maximum monster level. It would roam the dungeon and annihilate everyone and anyone it came across. Isolating and quarantining the sweeper so that it died of starvation was one way of dealing with it. The worst, laziest, cheapest way. It fit that idiotic mayor perfectly. If he had listened to Reeves and approved a proper subjugation quest immediately, then things would be different. His men and who knows how many others would still be alive. He took another swig of the bottle. After all, very few adventurers stuck around this province once they reached level 20 or so. The few who did were retirees, adventurers who did easy quests way below their pay grade so they could live peacefully and humbly. A lot of his guards were retired adventurers around level 15, too. Many of them were simply disillusioned when their childish dreams crashed into the impenetrable wall called reality. They had given up and settled down.
It's not a bad way to live life,
thought Reeves, before swallowing yet another mouthful of wine. But now, he would have to take action. He would put his foot down. Although he would still send an armed patrol to scout out the Janther's lair and confirm the elf's story, he was more or less convinced. The sweeper had broken. No, had been set free from the quarantine and was running amok in the nearby forests. Judging from Lalandros's disheartened babbling, it seemed to be a type of mimic. Since it clearly had access to some form of magic on top of being particularly vicious, Reeves made another conclusion. This sweeper was a variant or rare species that had appeared in the nearby dungeon. Most likely, it was summoned by this phantom saboteur to spread fear and terror among the populace. It was a common strategy of the elves during the Big War, so it was entirely possible. Later that day, Sergeant Hargan returned with the results of his investigation. Reeves had sent him to scout out the site of Lalandros's battle with the Janther. The sergeant reported three piles of ash being present at the scene. Two of them were wrapped in clothes and armor, and the third one was much too big to be a person. There was no sign of a headless corpse, but he did locate a huge day-old blood smear on the grass.
That settles it, thought Reeves.
The sweeper was definitely at large in that forest. He gave the order to assemble a punitive force to subjugate the threat. The minimum level required was 20, and the monetary compensation would be split up between the participants based on merit. As for the reward itself, the total amount came out to a formidable 860 gold pieces, or GP. It was a sizable sum that would allow a regular person to party it up for a whole 6 weeks, that or live off it for almost a year if they were frugal. Even if it had to be split up between several people, it was still an extremely attractive prize for a day's work. The captain didn't want to deal with that scumbag of a mayor, so he put the reward together himself. Most of this money came from the 500 GP set aside for the Janther bounty that was now void. The remaining 360 GP was collected from soldiers in the barracks. Word had spread among the tightly knit city guard that the subjugation target was the same bastard that murdered five of them. Some who were over level 20 volunteered. Most who couldn't or didn't participate directly gave freely of their own pockets. A larger reward would mean an increase of both quantity and quality of adventurers willing to take the quest. It was their own way of taking vengeance for the death of their friends and colleagues. And so, about 4 days later, a force of 23 people was gathered. 8 of those were guards. The remaining 15 people were adventurers. As per the quest requirements, they were all at least level 20, reaching up to level 27 in a few cases. This was the best they could gather on such short notice. But time was of the essence. They needed to stamp out that sweeper before it became too big a threat. The near 24 men and women were gathered outside the city gates, eager to set off. Reeves appeared on horseback and in full ceremonial armor and stood in front of them. He raised his arm to quiet the murmuring and began the briefing.
Thank you all for coming. I will now reveal what we know of the sweeper. Its species is suspected to be a mimic variant. We estimate its level to be in the higher 20s, possibly lower 30s.
Most of the adventurers found this news odd. The fact that this many people were gathered for one lousy box was, in a word, overkill. Some of the adventurers let out an amused snort, while others threw the captain a look that said, "What, that's it?" Reeves read the casual mood and immediately took action to dispel it.
"This is not, as you might think, overkill," he declared. "This monster is unnaturally intelligent and vicious. It has killed at least 50 people in the last 2 months, possibly many more. We also have good reason to believe it can use offensive magic with deadly consequences."
The gazes of everyone present sharpened. With this many people, even if the monster was level 50, they could probably take it down if they worked in waves, but only if it couldn't cast spells. Being able to attack with magic made a monster much more dangerous than it would be otherwise. If the level 50 monster in the previous example could use magic, then there was a good chance the punitive force would suffer heavy casualties. It might even be completely wiped out.
"We will commence a sweep of the woods. We will split into 4 6-man teams. Be mindful of anything even remotely box-shaped, including rocks and fallen tree trunks. Look for fresh blood smears, discarded gear, or piles of gray ash. If you find the monster, make sure you launch a flare immediately to notify the other teams of your position."
The captain held up a small wooden tube. It was 5 centimeters in diameter and 20 centimeters long. A string came out of one end of it. Everyone present had been given one of these earlier. Those not familiar with the device were briefly taught how to use it. The instruction consisted of someone saying, "Pull the string and a shiny thing will pop out the other end. Easy peasy." One would think that much would be obvious, but the guards knew better than to expect common sense from adventurers. A few of those drifters seemed genuinely surprised that the flare launchers were that simple to use.
"Do not get cocky and try to take it on by yourselves," cautioned the captain. "We've lost too many good people to this foul beast already. If you fuck up, you won't even leave a body behind for your bereaved loved ones to bury. Understood?"
"Yes, sir,"
came the immediate reply. The spirited response from the 8 soldiers seemed to invigorate the other adventurers. They realized that, for these guards, this was no longer just a job. It was personal, and if some pencil-pushing lazy bums were about to give this mission their all, then how could they, as professional monster hunters, possibly do any less? So what if guilds and law enforcement didn't always see eye to eye? They were still allies in the grand scheme of things.
"Very good," shouted the captain. "Sergeant Hargan will be taking over from here. I have given him command over this operation. Good luck, and Godspeed."
He saluted and rode off back inside the city without answering any questions. That's what Hargan was there for. Besides, the only questions the adventurers wanted to ask that captain were things like, "What the hell? You're not coming? What was the point of the horse and fancy armor? Why'd you even come out here in the first place, fat ass?" Part 4. A party of 5 were making their way through the thick forest. 2 armed guards led the way while 3 adventurers followed them. They were 1 out of 4 groups searching the forest for the sweeper that had appeared recently.
"Really? What was Sarge thinking?"
complained Mark. Harold frowned at him in response.
"The sergeant knows what he's doing. We need those 3's abilities, but they didn't have a vanguard. That's our job."
"I know that. I just can't really trust people that easily. Especially that rogue. He won't even tell us his name."
Harold shrugged lightly and looked over his shoulder, where the other 3 were following.
"Hey, buddy. What do we call you?"
The tall, slender man, who was wrapped head to toe in blackened leather, turned his gaze towards Harold.
"Buddy works," he said casually, "and I don't reveal my name because of guild policy. Occupational hazard, they call it. I'm sure you understand."
Harold turned back towards his colleague with a smirk.
"There, see? He's Buddy,"
Very funny, Harold.
Buddy was part of an adventurer guild called the Dark Hand. They didn't let anyone join unless they met the minimum requirements. Level 5 rogue main job with at least level 2 stealth skill. It was a den of thieves, spies, and assassins. Mark wondered how such a thing could possibly be legal. And while the general populace like himself might doubt it, that guild was completely legit. There was a very high demand for their services, after all. A rogue could disarm or set traps, pick locks, scout ahead under stealth, and murder the ever-living shit out of monsters. All things that were necessary in dungeons. Even once the battle started, they made themselves useful by keeping the enemy off balance. Smoke bombs, poisoned daggers, throwing knives, and all manner of other dirty tricks and tools made them reliable allies in many situations. Buddy was a particularly promising recruit. He was a level 21 rogue and level 6 alchemist. Choosing an artisan job for a side job might seem weird, but being able to brew his own potions and poisons was a huge help. Plus, the alchemist job and its related skills all raised dexterity, perception, and, to a lesser degree, endurance. A rogue could make good use out of all three of those attributes. The downside was that artisan-type jobs took a long time to train, but it was still a side job that matched perfectly with his main job. His status aside, he also looked the part. The tight leather bodysuit fit snugly around his arms, torso, butt, and thighs. While such armor couldn't really ward off blows, a rogue who was expecting to get hit was already a failure in his book. That's why his gear amplified his agility, allowing him to dodge and evade rather than block and parry. His head was completely hidden. A hood and mask covered everything but his shifty eyes and sharp ears. Although exposing his ears did help a bit with his hearing, the main reason he did that was to show he wasn't an elf. He had nothing against those people personally. If anything, he was a fan of elven women. However, a significant part of his clientele were humans who hated elves. They would trust the rogue more once they saw his ears weren't pointed. But the thing that irked Mark the most was the rogue's personality. Here they were, hunting a dangerous monster in the middle of the forest, and what was that shady guy doing?
I may be an honorable thief, but I believe it is your piercing stare that has stolen my heart.
He was hitting on the sole female in the group, the witch, Zira. For the past half hour, no less.
Ah, that's so sweet of you to say,
she replied, while blushing lightly.
You don't have to play along with that,
screamed Mark inside his head. He had tried reprimanding them at first, but had to give up since they refused to listen to him. He let out another sigh. In his eyes, that Zero woman was the root of the problem. The way those bright blue eyes darted all over the place while her mouth hung open was the telltale characteristic of a natural airhead. Her face was alluring, to say the least, and her waist-length blonde hair made her ooze with feminine charm. Her long, navy blue robe dragged slightly along the ground behind her. It had massive slits on either side of the skirt part, which exposed her long legs all the way up to the hip. The light fabric left her shoulders, collarbone, and back bare, while wide sleeves ran the length of her arms. The fact that this ridiculous outfit even stayed in place was nothing short of a miracle. Then there was the completely outrageous cleavage. Her breasts were absolutely massive, almost as large as her head, and swayed obscenely with every step. They pressed dangerously against the thin, low-cut garment. It was almost as if they were trying to rip it apart from the inside. If one had keen eyesight, they would be able to notice the subtle outline of her nipples, which hinted at her lack of upper body underwear. In short, she looked like a total bimbo. Her appearance and behavior were completely at odds with her claim of being a level 27 warlock. Mark wanted to question if that was really the case, but he knew better. Everyone here had submitted to a basic appraisal check to prove they fit the minimum requirements for this quest. Questioning his superior's ability like that would just earn him a week of cleaning toilets. At least the last member of his group was reasonable. Karas was a level 21 priest, no side jobs. He wore sensible white robes with delicate golden embroidery around the wrists, heart, and waist, garb typical of those in service to the gods. He had a thick, dignified beard and mustache that went down to his stomach. His bald head seemed to gleam unnaturally in the sunlight. Kuras was also well-built, hinting that the steel mace on his hip was not just for show. He wasn't without fault, though. Kuras was a dwarf, and like most dwarves, traveling with him came with two very specific problems. The first one was that he was short. His stubby legs meant he had trouble keeping up with the others and had to constantly half-jog after them. The second issue was that dwarves were really weak to the lure of alcohol. Kuras was no exception. He would occasionally bring out a hip flask from inside his robe and take a swig from it. It was fine, though. Dwarves were of stout constitutions and needed a lot more than that to get tipsy. All things considered, the guy who reeked of whiskey seemed way more reliable than the shifty rogue and the ditzy witch. Just as Mark had rebuilt his focus on the path ahead, Zira suddenly let out an embarrassed,
"No!"
There was the sound of a slap and a yell of pain from Buddy.
"I can't do that sort of thing with you,"
she continued, while covering her face with both hands. It seemed that Buddy had pushed his luck a little too far.
"Will you cut that out? This is enemy territory," shouted Mark.
He couldn't take it anymore. Was this the sort of attitude adventurers had while on the road? Yes, actually. This was more or less how those people behaved while in transit. A guard living in a relatively peaceful city like Mon Atal would have no idea how stressful adventuring could get once you approached level 30. If these people didn't let off steam regularly, they'd implode.
"What's your problem, man?"
said Buddy, while rubbing his cheek. That slap from earlier had more power behind it than it looked.
"I'm properly keeping an eye out, you know." "Like hell you are!"
shouted Mark. Sighed the rogue. This was why he hated working with civilians.
"Fine, let me prove it."
He took out a small, straight knife from his belt and threw it up and to his right. It cut through the air without making a sound before hitting something in the branches of a tree. He then pulled deftly on the almost invisible steel wire, reeling the knife back into his hand. It had cleanly skewered a small brown squirrel.
"My perception is really good. See? My ears alone can detect anything trying to sneak up on us. They can even beat a level 4 sneak skill, you know."
Mark blinked a few times, processing what just happened. That man behind him had just hit a small target some 20 meters away without so much as looking at it.
"Tch,"
he clicked his tongue.
"All right, you win. Just keep it down, will you?"
Harold expected this much already, but he too was impressed. Kuras was in his drink at the moment, so he missed the display entirely. Zira, however, had a different opinion on the matter.
"That poor fuzzy thing!"
she wailed.
"How could you? You there, Shorty. You're a priest, right? Can you heal this little guy?"
"Huh? What? Who?"
blurted out the startled dwarf as he hurriedly put his flask away.
"Oh, a squirrel. That our lunch. Good work, lad."
"Thanks, old-timer,"
replied Buddy in good humor.
"But I think lunch will have to wait. I smell blood."
"Well, why? It's all over your hand there."
"No, not this,"
said the rogue before throwing the squirrel carcass to the ground.
"Monster blood. It's coming in from the east. My guess, about 500 meters.
He pointed towards the tree line to their left.
"And look," he continued, "there's some weird markings on the trees here. Like something was trying to take a bite out of them."
The group stared at the tree in question. Forget trying. Something had actually succeeded in taking a sizable chunk out of the thick trunk. And judging from those odd marks, it wasn't a stretch to say they were teeth tracks.
"Should we send the flare?"
"Not yet, Kuras,"
said Mark.
"We need to confirm it with our own eyes first."
He and Harold both unsheathed their swords and readied their shields.
"Arms at the ready. We're going to check it out."
Buddy pulled twin daggers from the sheath at his lower back. He took out a small vial from a pouch on his hip and applied the viscous green liquid inside it to his blades. Zira's normally vacant expression became almost unnaturally focused. She seemed like a completely different person. She reached over her shoulder and took the heavy wooden staff out of its leather sling, gripping it tightly with both hands. The rogue studied the staff curiously. The upper end of the wood curved like the letter C and had a purple crystal ball that floated inside the half-circle. It looked fancy, expensive. How come he didn't notice it earlier? Ah, probably because it was behind Zira's back while her voluptuous breasts were, as expected, on her chest. Kuras was already holding his mace in his right hand, while his left reached into his robes. Only this time, instead of a flask, he took out a small black book, the Scripture of the Sun. He went down on one knee and put the book to his forehead. He mumbled something under his breath before finishing the chant with,
"Blessing of the Sun!"
Everyone present started glowing with a faint yellow light. A few seconds later, it faded away. You are now under the effects of Sun's Blessing. Maximum HP, plus 120. The effect will last for 60 minutes or until it is overridden by another blessing. Whistled Buddy.
Not bad, old-timer.
Judging from these numbers, he guessed Kuras to have a level 6 prayer skill.
To think the most devout priest I'd ever seen around these parts would be an alcoholic.
His light joke wasn't far off the mark. While the dwarf may not have had a side job, being able to devote himself fully to his god had its own merits. Such as being able to focus on training the skills that really mattered. Not to mention a particularly powerful perk if he became a level 25 priest with no side jobs.
Ain't nothing in the scripture that says us priests can't enjoy a good drink, lad.
Buddy smirked to himself. He wasn't a particularly religious guy, but he had to admit the sun god Solus was probably his favorite one. His clergy were definitely more fun than any of the others he'd seen. Not to mention the priestesses who worshipped him always seemed to have amazing boobs. With their preparations ready, the group of five headed off into the lush forest. They warily crossed between trees and bushes, keeping a close eye for anything that the mimic could be disguised as. Even if it was a shapeshifter, a mimic could not shrink or drastically alter its rectangular body. This was true for both the lesser and greater species of the monster. However, it could drastically change the way it looked on the surface. Along the way, they pierced and attacked several suspect rocks, two fallen trees, and one stump. They followed the trail of gnawed trunks and curiously chopped off tree branches. Buddy felt an odd sense of incongruity. He decided to give voice to his concerns.
I think our target is inviting us in. The trail's way too obvious.
Aye. That bugger's supposed to be smarter than this, right?
It's still a mimic, though,
said Zira, while climbing over a small ridge.
Even if it became 10 times smarter than normal, it would still be as dumb as a rock.
Harold decided to chime in.
She has a point, but I'm with Buddy. This is way too suspicious.
The party moved onward carefully, watching their every step and minding their bearings. After about 10 minutes of painfully slow progress, they arrived at a clearing. Rather than a natural meadow, something had cleared out all the trees in the vicinity and turned them into about 20 small, flimsy huts.
Goblins,
muttered the rogue under his breath. A goblin was a monster that vaguely looked like a 10- or 11-year-old child. It had green skin, a bony physique, and exceptionally long nose, chin, and ears. Regular goblins hovered around level 10 or 15, but that was just a formality. The weak body of a goblin meant that, despite its actual level, its true strength was closer to a level 8 or 9 monster. But goblins never fought one-on-one. They attacked in great numbers and often roamed in packs of dozens, maybe hundreds of them. They often made crude villages like this one where they could breed and multiply like the vermin they were. But this village had already been exterminated.
What the fuck?
Mark was so shocked he reflexively cursed. The scenery that unfurled before him was entirely too familiar. There was blood everywhere. It painted the walls of the flimsy hovels. Bits of goblin flesh were strewn about the place. Piles of gray ash littered the scenery. But one overwhelming theme was immediately apparent. There was not a single corpse left behind. It was almost exactly like what he had witnessed firsthand in that damned dungeon. Only it looked like the monster had tried its absolute darndest to outdo itself. Since their glorious leader was currently staring slack-jawed at the scene, Buddy decided to take charge.
Think it's hiding in here? He whispered. There's a lot of crappy baskets and pots around the place.
Yeah,
nodded Kuras.
Them logs around the campfire are also pretty suspect. Could be in the huts, too.
I have an idea. I can try to smoke it out,
suggested Zira.
Won't you be wasting your MP? I thought those ruin spells were quite costly.
They are, but I'll be fine, Harold. I have over 1,000 MP, you know.
The men shared several glances and nodded at Zira. They moved closer to the village as a group without dropping their guard, even for an instant. After walking closer to the edge of the village, Zira signaled everyone to stop. The witch held her staff up towards the sky and closed her eyes. And then she started chanting her spell.
There is nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to run. This village will burn like the heart of the sun.
She chanted it clearly and purposefully, her voice echoing unnaturally.
With infinite glee, I call upon thee.
A chill ran down the men's spines. They had a very bad feeling about this.
Inferno!
She shouted at the top of her lungs. A massive hurricane of red-hot flames appeared out of nowhere and swept across the goblin village. It must have been at least 10 meters in diameter and 5 meters tall. It only lasted several seconds, but that was enough to set the entire village ablaze. A wide smile appeared on Zira's face. It was so wide that it seemed like her jaw was about to fall off. She giggled. She spread her arms and let out a maniacal four-stage laugh. Her eyes gazed madly at the flames that ravaged the wooden huts and turned everything in front of her to ash. The rest of the group merely went, "Ah, there it is," inside their heads. Nobody knew how or why, but it was a sort of unspoken rule that female casters were all fucked in the head. This seemed especially true for offense-type jobs like the witch. In Zira's case, it was obvious that she had a bit of a pyromaniac streak going on. The way she cackled like that made it clear she had forgotten completely about her surroundings. This was a serious fault that could one day lead to her death.
"Get down!"
screamed Buddy. Everyone besides the still laughing psycho hit the dirt. A streak of dark matter flew above them, precisely through the spot where the dwarven priest's head was half a second ago. It kept going for several more meters before fizzling out of existence.
"Aegis!"
screamed Koros. A transparent bubble of golden light wrapped around the party. A second mass of darkness slammed into the hastily constructed barrier. The Aegis spell couldn't take it and shattered, but proved enough to repel the attack. Buddy recognized the Shadow Bolt spell. He leaped to his feet while shouting,
"It's a warlock!"
to his comrades. In his right hand he held 3 throwing knives, poised between his fingers. He threw the trio of blades at a particular tree some 20 meters away. The rogue was aiming at a rather dense pile of leaves, which he had confirmed was the origin of both Shadow Bolts with his heightened senses. In an instant, the leaves opened up to reveal an array of dagger-like teeth and a thick red tongue. The out-of-place maw swallowed up the 3 throwing knives like they were an afternoon snack.
"Kasha!"
screamed the mimic. Since it was already discovered, its leaf camouflage was now useless. It leaped from the tree branch it was sitting on. By the time it hit the ground, it had already returned to its regular appearance, that of a wooden chest frame with 6 black spider-like feet and a trio of tongue tentacles gripping a sword each. Having confirmed their target, Mark grabbed hold of his flare launcher. He aimed it at the sky and pulled on the string. There was a bang and a flash as the bright red flare shot off screaming into the blue sky. Having confirmed the signal was sent, he turned his attention towards the monster. In the next instant, he felt something small and sharp fly past his face, leaving a scratch on his cheek. "You have suffered a minor scratch. HP minus 2. You have been poisoned. HP minus 20. Your movements have been dulled by the poison." Buddy, who had already distanced himself from the 2 warriors in the front, broke out into a cold sweat. He recognized the projectile that grazed Mark as his own poisoned throwing knife. One of the 3 he had thrown at the mimic just moments ago, to be precise. The monster had somehow caught it inside its mouth and had thrown it back with speed rivaling his own. If its aim was better, Mark would have a metal handle sticking out of his eye socket right now. Buddy wasn't a particularly religious guy, but he still found himself offering a silent prayer to whatever god was listening.
Please let our backup get here in time.
Part 5. Sergeant Hargan ran as fast as he could through the forest. Two of his men followed behind him. One was a warrior like the sergeant, the other was a paladin. Up in front was the three-man adventurer team that was part of his group. A ranger, a berserker, and a cryomancer. All human women. Though one would normally question if that extremely ripped and tall berserker with the short hair was truly female. She was so masculine that it was impossible to tell whether those lumps on her chest were breasts or pecs. At least the ranger and cryomancer were more pleasant to look at. If he were a more indecent man, Hargan would probably relish the view of their tight butts as they strained against the two's tight leather trousers. But he was not like that. He knew full well such thoughts had no place on the battlefield. Besides, his wife would probably murder him if she even suspected he was looking at young girls' behinds. The six of them were rushing towards the flare signal sent up by another team. The ranger at the very front deftly and precisely navigated through the forest, while the berserker mowed down any trees and monsters in her way with her gigantic sword. That job was vastly different from warriors who focused on fighting through techniques like blocking, parrying, and riposting. A berserker was a killing machine that ran on anger, blood, and death. Once the red haze enveloped them, they became unstoppable fighting machines who made one question who was the real monster. Even if they thrived in combat, the side effects of their reckless fighting style meant their bodies were often left in a dire state. Ending a long battle riddled with wounds, bleeding heavily and with several broken bones was pretty much the norm for them. It was not a job for the weak-hearted. The cryomancer, on the other hand, valued precision. Her main method of attack was launching shards of conjured ice at her opponents. She could also fire an icy beam that froze everything it touched or summon a localized blizzard to blind and confuse her enemy. All of those spells required a high degree of accuracy to demonstrate their full effect. After all, if a cryomancer's enchanted ice pierced a flesh and blood body, it would almost always explode into shards. The unfortunate victim's insides would be shredded by that frozen shrapnel, causing massive damage. A truly gruesome and ruthless method of attack, and one Hargan hoped would be able to subdue this sweeper. A thought he would likely be able to confirm sooner rather than later. Another team had sent a flare, signaling they had confirmed its location. That was 15 minutes ago. Judging from how everyone was told to spread out, Hargan's team would be the closest one to the distress signal. Thankfully, there was a tall pillar of smoke that rose up from the same direction, so they could easily find their bearings. And half a minute later, they would be at the scene. The six of them burst out of the tree line into an unnatural clearing. Nearby was a small village, probably goblin in nature, that was set ablaze. The scenery between Hargan and that rampaging fire bore the scars of a fierce battle that was already over. He immediately recognized two of his guardsmen. Mark and Harold were both slain, covered head to toe in wounds and lying in a puddle of their combined blood. It looked like the finishing blows were a sword through the throat for Mark and a small knife in the eye for Harold. The sergeant cursed under his breath. He didn't give a rat's ass about those opportunistic adventurers, but losing his men was another story. A few meters away from those two was the body of a dwarven priest, his white robes dyed a crimson red. The left part of his head had been blown clean off, most likely by magic. Much like how that elven survivor had described it, the sweeper had probably taken out the healer first. About a dozen meters further away lay the corpse of that rogue from the Dark Hand Guild. Most of his right arm and left leg were gone, probably bitten off in the struggle. He had a small knife sticking out from his left shoulder, identical to the one lodged in Harold's skull. And sitting in front of the blazing inferno, hugging her knees and gently rocking herself back and forth, was the witch, Zira. The sole survivor was making eerie sounds as she stared at the flames. It sounded like she couldn't decide if she wanted to giggle or weep. Hargan, as the leader of his squad, signaled the others to move forward. They walked carefully towards her, keeping an eye on their surroundings. There was quite a lot of debris strewn around the place, so there was no telling where the sweeper might pop out from. Zira froze and went quiet when she heard them approach from behind her. After a few seconds, she looked over her shoulder at them. After confirming their presence, she returned her gaze to the dancing flames. The witch then held out her right arm and pointed to the side with a slender finger, right at the smoldering lump of something some 15 meters away from her.
"It's dead,"
she muttered in a shaky voice.
"It was heavily wounded after killing the others. It tried to run, but I finished it off."
Having finished her bare-bones explanation, the poor woman withdrew her hand and resumed her earlier behavior. The six who had just arrived at the grisly scene shared a few difficult looks. They approached the supposed dead sweeper. Once they got closer, they were able to confirm it. It was an organic chest with teeth. About 2/3 of it was burned to a crisp, letting off a repugnant smell. There were 3 plain-looking and well-used swords on the ground around it. It sat there perfectly still, not showing a single sign of life. Hargan stabbed it with his spear just in case. It penetrated deep into the corpse, causing a small trickle of yellow blood to leak out of the wound.